Let's go ahead and get started. I'd like to give Professor Leroy Walters a big UVA welcome. It's wonderful having you here. As we were chatting before class, we both realized that while we've had some pleasant exchanges in the past, that they've all been at conferences in Western Europe, and so this is our first time to meet stateside, even though we're just 2 hours away. But it's wonderful having you here in the spring series on Theology of the Third Reich to speak on Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the euthanasia and eugenics policies in the 1930s and early 1940s. I'd like to just say a few words about our distinguished guest speaker, who is Joseph P. Kennedy, Senior Professor of Christian Ethics at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics and Professor of Philosophy at Georgetown University. Professor Walters was born in Illinois, spent his elementary school and secondary school years in Pennsylvania, and attended a small liberal arts college. It's in Grantham, Pennsylvania, Messiah College, that some of you may know. I know it well. I've had a wonderful relationship with that terrific college and its Peace Studies Center over the past 10 years. After finishing a BA degree at the Associated Mennonite Seminaries in 1965, Dr. Walters studied for 2 years in Germany, one at the University of Heidelberg, and then another year at the Free University of Berlin. What faculty were you studying in at the Free?
Political science and theology.
Was Gollwitzer?
Gollwitzer was there.
Your host?
Yes.
Yeah.
He taught a seminar on the Sermon on the Mount when I was there.
Well, I did once take a nap in his Barcelona day bed in his office that Ralph Rustenberg later took over. And I was pleased to know that the great Gollwitzer took a nap every afternoon at 3 o'clock sharp. In any case, while in Berlin, Dr. Walters helped to organize the East-West conferences in East Berlin, the German Democratic Republic, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. In 1967, Dr. Walters returned to the U.S. and began a PhD program in religious studies at Yale University, and finished his PhD in Christian ethics in the spring of 1971, writing on five classic just war theories. This dissertation received the Theron Rockwell Field Prize from the university. Who was your dissertation advisor?
Jim Gustafson.
Jim Gustafson, of course. During the summer of 1971, Dr. Walters joined the newly established Joseph and Rose Kennedy Institute of Ethics at Georgetown as the first faculty member appointed to the multi-year term, and remained a member of the Kennedy Institute and still remains a member of the Kennedy Institute a year and a half after his formal retirement in 2010. And 1993, he was named the Joseph P. Kennedy Senior Professor of Christian Ethics, and during the summer of 1996, he accepted a 3-year term as director of the Kennedy Institute and serving there as director through June of 2000. As a very distinguished curriculum vitae, which I'll pass around, I probably won't read the entire 25-page document, but it'll give you a sense of the breadth of his scholarship and the importance of his scholarship. I'll be happy to make this available if you'd like to have a more detailed bibliography of Dr. Walters' work. Since 1975, Dr. Walters has been the editor and co-editor of the annual Bibliography of Bioethics, and I think that's 37 or 38 volumes to date, and also co-editor of Contemporary Issues in Bioethics and co-author of The Ethics of Human Gene Therapy. Since 2003, Dr. Walters has devoted major attention to Holocaust studies and to the euthanasia program initiated in 1939, and of course that research brings him to our seminar today. He has conducted detailed research on one major opponent of euthanasia, the asylum director, Paul Gerhard Brauna, about whom we read today. If you don't have a paper, a copy of that paper, I'll be happy to make that available to you, send it to you by email shortly after class, and also does research on the life and thought of the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. One of the projects that Dr. Walters is particularly excited about that I want to mention before turning over the seminar to him is since his retirement in 2010, he has become a participant in the fellowship program FOSPA, I guess is the acronym. What is the, say that, what's it called again, fellowship?
Fellowships at Auschwitz for the Study of Professional Ethics. FOSPI.
And that's covering four fields now, religious studies, medicine,
law,
and journalism. And this next summer will be the third summer of this summer abroad program. And I highly recommend this program to you. If you're interested, I think that for religious studies, this is primarily for graduate students and seminarians, correct? Not open to undergraduates just yet.
That's right.
Unless we fudge some paperwork or something in the case of some of you. But in any case, I'd love to make that available to you, and it's a very exciting program. Leroy, it's wonderful having you here today, and we look forward to your presentation. What we'll do is we'll have about 45 minutes or an hour presentation, take a 2 or 3 minute coffee break, then reconvene for Q&A until 5:30. And then at 5:35, I'll need my seminar for just a few bookkeeping purposes. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Charles, for that generous introduction. It's a pleasure to be here with you. If at any point something that I say is not clear, please raise your hand and I'll try to clarify. And I will have a few questions for you early in the presentation. So, here are the central questions I'd like to discuss with you. What did Bonhoeffer know and when did he know it? And how important were the issues of eugenic sterilization and the killing of people with disabilities to Bonhoeffer? And then how does his thinking about the treatment of people with disabilities relate to his overall approach to ethics and theology? I've really searched hard in the works of Bonhoeffer for relevant materials. And as far as I can tell, there are primarily six documents from his lifetime that are relevant to this question. There are two personal letters. There's one sermon, some draft sections of a book that he planned to write on ethics, a report by a conversation partner in Geneva, Switzerland, and then a jointly authored appeal by Bonhoeffer and one other person that was directed to members of a resistance group. So if you think of the 16 volumes of Bonhoeffer's works, that's not very much material on our topic. But I'll try to argue that he has a consistent position throughout his lifetime, even during the years when he's pretty silent on these topics. So we'll identify we'll examine these six sources, and then we'll try to identify six milestones in Bonhoeffer's life and thought. So here's milestone one. It was a letter written from an asylum in Bethel to his paternal grandmother, who was named Julie Toffel Bonhoeffer. It was dated August 20th, 1933. And it's actually a birthday greeting to his grandmother. He's apologizing for not being in Berlin, where his grandmother was living with his parents in Berlin at this time. Here's a photo of the director of Bethel, Friedrich von Bodelschwenk, greeting one of the residents of the Bethel facility. It was a huge facility with about 5,000 residents during Bonhoeffer's time.
Here's a cover page from a book about the history of the Bethel facility, Spurensuche, the look for looking around for clues. And here you see some of the residents of the facility. And I think this was the 25th wedding anniversary of Friedrich von Bodelschwenk and his spouse. And so all the children were dressed in very festive garb for this happy occasion. So here's what Bonhoeffer writes to his feisty grandmother. This was the grandmother who, on the day of the boycott in Berlin, April 1st, went down to one of the big department stores that was owned by Jews. It's called Kaufhaus des Westens, or KDW, and there were stormtroopers standing out front trying to discourage people from shopping there. And she walked between the stormtroopers into the department store and said, "I shop wherever I want to." So that gives you a little feel for his grandmother. Dietrich really looked up to her. The time here in Bethel has made a deep impression on me. I've just come back from a worship service. It's an extraordinary sight, the whole church filled with crowds of epileptics and other ill persons. What utter madness when some people think that the sick can or ought to be legally eliminated. It's almost like building a Tower of Babel and must bring vengeance on us. Today in church, I was constantly reminded of Rembrandt's 100 Guilder etching and the gospel stories that it illustrates. So here's the etching. I had the privilege of seeing several prints of this at the Philadelphia Museum of Art about 3 months ago. But it's a composite of passages from this chapter in Matthew. On the right are ill people coming to Jesus. Sort of left center is a woman bringing her child to Jesus to be blessed. Here's a little closer picture of some of the ill people, someone sick enough to be brought in a kind of a wheelbarrow. Here's a detail. At the lower left is the rich young ruler who's thinking things through. Does he want to give up all that he has and follow Jesus, or does he want to keep his riches? And I think Peter is trying to cut off the woman and saying, "Don't bother Jesus, he's got other things to do," but Jesus is kind of holding him back with his hand. So why was Bonhoeffer talking about a Tower of Babel and people with disabilities in August of 1933? Well, this law for the prevention of hereditarily diseased offspring, terrible name for a law, had been passed in July of 1933, and that's what Bonhoeffer was talking about. And what did the law say? Anyone who has a hereditary illness can be rendered sterile by a surgical operation if there's a strong probability that his or her progeny will suffer from serious hereditary defects of a physical or mental nature. So, what does that include? Well, it was very explicit. Anyone is hereditarily ill within the meaning of the law who suffers from one of the following illnesses: congenital feeble-mindedness, schizophrenia, manic depression, hereditary epilepsy, Huntington's chorea, hereditary blindness, hereditary deafness, serious physical deformities. Do you have any observations about that list? Yes.
How vague feeble-mindedness?
Yes, it's a pretty vague notion, isn't it? I mean, we would talk about intellectual disability now rather than very pejorative term like feeblemindedness.
Not all those things are hereditary.
No. I mean, what percentage of cases of intellectual disability are genetically linked, and what percentage are idiosyncratic, unexplained when they occur? What about epilepsy? Do you know anyone who has epilepsy or is prone to seizures? Bonhoeffer was amazed when he was at this service in Bethel that there were caretakers stationed sort of throughout the congregation in case any epileptics keeled over during the Sunday morning worship service, because they could go and help them set them upright again. So, and serious physical deformities, well, that also is kind of vague. In addition...
Did he use the term manic depression?
Yes, they used the term manic depression.
Okay.
Yep. Huntington's chorea is a single gene hereditary disorder. So they were right about that one being passed on. Of course, people with Huntington's disease have 30 or 40 years of very normal life, and then they begin to deteriorate. So who's to say that it's better not to have been born than to have Huntington's chorea? And I thought the Americans with Disabilities Act had something to do with vision disorders and hearing disorders. I mean, there are other ways to approach people who have these disorders. And then, what is chronic alcoholism, and what does that have to do with genes? I'm puzzled. Well, it turns out that the German Reich, the Hitler regime, did not think up this law on their own. They actually got it from the United States. And it was these categories mirror almost point for point a model law that a man named Harry Lachlan had worked out in the late teens and the early 20s. And Virginia was certainly happy to adopt this kind of law for the sterilization of people with intellectual disabilities and mental illness. So in the United States, it was a state-by-state decision. You've probably seen discussions from North Carolina recently about compensating people who had been sterilized under the state statute. Virginia, there's a memorial here, a memorial plaque commemorating Carrie Buck, the woman who was thought to be the third generation of imbeciles, in the words of the U.S. Supreme Court, which held that Virginia's statute was constitutional for sterilizing people with disabilities. Milestone 2, a sermon preached in a London church, probably in 1934. Bonhoeffer gave up a very promising academic career at the University of Berlin in 33. He was a young theologian. I think if he had just compromised a little bit more, and stayed away from politically charged topics, he could have maintained his academic position the whole way through wartime. That was not the path that he chose. And so it was kind of a flight from a situation that was becoming increasingly impossible. He went to London for 2 years and ministered to two congregations of German-speaking Protestants. Here's the outside of one of the churches where he ministered. So his text on a particular Sunday in probably 34 was, "My strength is made perfect in weakness." Have you ever seen a greater mystery in this world than ill people, insane people? people who cannot help themselves but have just to rely on other people for help, for love, for care. Have you ever thought what outlook on life a cripple, a homeless, hopelessly ill man, a socially exploited man, a colored man in a white country, an untouchable may have? We all know that Christianity has been blamed ever since its early days for its message to the weak. Christianity is a religion of slaves, of people with inferiority complexes. It owes its success only to the masses of miserable people whose weakness and misery Christianity has glorified. So that sounds a little like Nietzsche's attack on Christianity. Why is suffering holy? Because God has suffered in the world from man, and wherever he comes, he has to suffer again. God has suffered on the cross. It is therefore that all human suffering and weakness is sharing God's own suffering and weakness in the world. We are suffering. God is suffering much more. Our God is a suffering God. This is long before Jürgen Moltmann came on the scene. Now there's a long period of silence from 34 to 40. And I'll just try to fill in some of the major events in Bonhoeffer's life and then say a little bit about what was happening in German politics and foreign policy during this time. After he served for 2 years as the pastor of the churches in London, he came back to Germany, but he didn't resume his post at the University of Berlin and go on to this promising career, being promoted to associate and full professor. Instead, he starts teaching at a little unapproved underground seminary out in Finkenwalde, near the town of Stettin, which is today in Poland. He teaches in this seminary for 2 years, and then the Gestapo closes down the seminary because it's too dangerous and political. It's a threat to the regime. So he and his Eberhard Bethge in particular think up a new tack, and they develop what are called collective pastorates. So if he can't teach in one place in Finkenwalde, they go to two towns in particular, and they hold training classes for seminary students in those areas. In the second case, they lived in a pastor's home and taught out of that for a while, but then the pastor needed the home for his family, so they went to a little hut out in the countryside in Pomerania. Pomerania is the northeast part of Germany, north and east of Berlin. I liken it to, say, North Dakota or Montana or Idaho. We think of the Rocky Mountain area and the west being less populated than the east coast. And I think Pomerania had some of that same frontier mentality. Then Bonhoeffer was forbidden to reside, do pastoral work, or teach in Berlin. In fact, he was only allowed to go to Berlin to visit his family. So the Gestapo was tracking him, and they were worried about what kind of activity he might be involved in. In February of 38, he made his initial contacts with members of the German resistance. And then in the summer of 39, he came back to the United States. He had studied for a year at Union earlier. And his friends had said, "Dietrich, it's really too dangerous for you to be in Germany. You need to get out while you can. There's no future for you there." But I think even while he was on the boat on the way to the United States, he realized he had made a mistake. So he stayed a few days and he sailed back to Germany. He said, I have to be with my people when they're going through this difficult time with Hitler. So in July of 39, he comes back. Now there are two other key events that occur in 1939. His brother-in-law, married to his sister, Christine, joins military intelligence, the Abwehr, in August of 1939. Hans von Danagy was a longtime opponent of the Hitler regime, first within the Justice Department. His enemies tried to prove that he had non-Aryan parents, as they were called, or at least non-Aryan ancestors. So he joined this group. The military intelligence was a huge organization. According to one estimate, it had about 13,000 members in all. And probably 50 of those 13,000 people were in opposition to Hitler. And that's less than 0.5%. But Hans von Danagy found those people. And then this is something that's only come out in recent research on Bonhoeffer. In fact, the document that this is based on was only discovered in a Czech archive in the early 1990s. And it's the dossier that was put together after the interrogation of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Hans von Danagy when they were imprisoned. And in a letter to his military recruiting station, we would say to your draft local draft board, although that's not a big issue for most of us anymore, he claims that he has an assignment with military intelligence. And this is a book by Sabina Dram, translated into English, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Resistance. And this is what Bonhoeffer says in a letter that we wouldn't have known about if it hadn't been for the interrogation of Bonhoeffer. He says in this October 12, 39 letter, "In the meantime, I have been given an assignment by the Armed Forces High Command that I must carry out in Berlin. Colonel Oster, Armed Forces High Command, Tirpitz-Ufer Achtzig, 80, today authorized me to let you know that he is prepared to explain in case of further inquiry. For this reason, I will be living for the time being in Berlin with my father." And his father was Karl Bonhoeffer, a very well-known psychiatrist, the chair of the psychiatry and neurology department at the University of Berlin. So Bonhoeffer is telling the military authorities, I can't be conscripted into military service. I already have a job with military intelligence. And by the way, that gives me permission to be in Berlin. And when I'm in Berlin, I'll be staying with my father. I don't think this letter is totally truthful, to be honest with you. I think it's one of the first evidences that we have of Bonhoeffer living a double life. He seemed to be working with the churches and helping people training for the ministry, but he's getting more and more implicated with the resistance. And in a way, I think he's given up on the confessing church, that it's not willing to take the kind of risks that he thinks it ought to take. So, now what's happening in the world around Bonhoeffer from 34 to 40? Well, that's a long stretch of time. But let me say a few words about Adolf Hitler at this point. Adolf Hitler was a World War I veteran. He was wounded in war. He was temporarily blinded by an attack of mustard gas late in the war. And while he was recovering in the hospital, Germany surrendered. And so all of his sacrifices were for naught. In some ways, I think he had post-traumatic stress disorder for the rest of his life. He could not believe that after all he had done and all the comrades he had seen die in battle, that Germany surrendered. And then came the Treaty of Versailles about 9 months later, having been extorted by the French and the British with their blockade. And so something had to be done to set things right. Hitler was also a very impatient man. He was kind of fatalistic. He thought that he wouldn't live terribly long. He knew some of his enemies were out to get him, to do away with him. And so he thought that if he was going to do anything, he would have to do it sooner rather than later. Now, he also had theories about race and space. He thought Germany was too crowded and it needed an empire. It had lost its empire in Africa after World War I. And so he had in mind some successful empires that had been run by Aryans. Do you know who Aryans were? Who were the Aryans? Well, they were the master race. They were the northern Europeans, the descendants of the Teutonic Knights, the people who were superior to Slavs and Orientals and Mediterranean peoples and the French. I think Nordic gets there. I mean, he was willing to think that people in Denmark and Sweden were Aryans. And think about the notion of Anglo-Saxon people. Where did the Angles and Saxons come from? Well, they came from Germany over to Britain. So one of his models was Britain. Britain is a terrific empire. It's run by Aryans. Of course, they're competing with Germany, but you have to admire the way they've subjugated India, the way they have a colony in South Africa. I mean, the British, look at Canada, Australia, I mean, the British Empire is amazing. So even though he saw Britain as a rival to Germany, he gave credit to the Aryans, and he kind of hated to attack the Aryans in Great Britain, but on the other hand, they were standing in his way. Now, there's one other very successful empire, and it wasn't scattered all over islands around the world. It was more a single land mass. Where was that other empire? Yeah? Do you have a guess? Yes, the United States. So think about this. In Hitler's mind, it's the Aryans from Europe who come to the New World, and who do they find here? Well, inferior peoples. And he gives more credit to the people of German ancestry than was the case, but, so the Spaniards don't figure very largely in his story. But the Aryans came to this land. They discovered that it was occupied by an inferior group of people, But gradually they conquered an empire and marched all the way across to the Pacific. It's manifest destiny. And all Hitler wanted to do was replicate this story in Europe, but expanding to the east. And the Slavs were the inferior people that he had to overcome in Europe. So all he wanted to do was to do what the settlers in the New World had done, just in the opposite direction. And he didn't understand why anyone should begrudge Germany the chance to build an empire in Europe. He needed the Ukraine for farmland. They didn't have enough farmland in Germany. He needed the oil fields in the Caucasus. It was just natural that he would want to expand, and that meant that eventually he would have to wage war with the Soviet Union. And his view was that Britain was kind of sleepy, tired of war. Soviet Union, Stalin had just purged a lot of his generals, so if he struck early, he had the best chance of winning. He thought if he waited till the 1940s, 42, 43, the Soviet Union might have rebuilt. Britain might have beefed up its navy or its air force, and then Germany would be at a comparative disadvantage. And besides, he didn't know what the United States would do. He thought that the longer that the United States had great potential, and it was important to do something before the United States build up its own armaments. So that's Hitler's view of the world, and that's why he decided to, he made a very fateful decision, really, to try to attack the Soviet Union. So during this time, 34 to 40, about 300,000 Germans were sterilized surgically. Let's remember that this is the pre-antibiotic era. For a woman, sterilization for tubal ligation or cutting the fallopian tubes was abdominal surgery with the risks of infection and death. For men, it was less serious, a vasectomy, but still a major invasion of the body. So then you see Hitler just gradually threatening neighbors, Czechoslovakia. Austria was happy to join Germany. There was the Kristallnacht, so-called the Night of Broken Glass. Germany attacked Poland, and the adult euthanasia program began in Poland and Germany in late 39 and early 1940. Hitler's view, I think, was that while people were focused on war, he could do things domestically that he couldn't get away with when people were not focused on war. So we come to milestone 3, a letter written from a rural hiding place in Pomerania. And this is the personal letter from Dietrich Bonhoeffer to his parents, dated February 27, 1940. So you have a copy of this letter. I really enjoy this letter because it just shows how much he could squeeze into one short letter. So first of all, he tells his parents, I applied for to be a chaplain in the military. That is, he was not going to fire a weapon on behalf of Hitler's armies under any circumstances. But I was turned down for that, so that plan is out the window. It's been a really cold winter here. We have an indescribable black ice following strong flooding. And then this sentence. Papa will certainly have heard in detail about the closing of the Pomeranian mental institutions. This is how I translated that sentence before the new English translation came out last November. About the closing, of the Pomeranian institutions for the mentally ill, Papa will surely have heard detailed reports. This is someone writing in code to his parents. He worries that this letter could be intercepted and read by the Gestapo. And so it looks very harmless. Papa, you're a psychiatrist. Do you have an interest in people with mental illness? You've probably heard that some of these Pomeranian institutions have been closed. And then in the final sentence, final paragraph of the letter, dear Mama, would you please purchase the soap for February on Eberhard's soap card? I am sending a package with dirty laundry. So it's a variety of topics in this single letter.
As far as we know, that's not code.
That's not code. No, that was real. So what did Bonhoeffer mean with this sentence, the closing of the Pomeranian institutions? Well, here's a map of Pomerania. You see Berlin on the lower left. And then up toward the top left is a place called Stralsund. That was a large, very modern institution for people with intellectual disabilities and mental illness. And near the top right is an institution called Lauenburg. The Gauleiter, the political leader of Pomerania, was an ardent National Socialist. And apparently one day he and Heinrich Himmler got together, and Himmler said, you know, Franz Schleder, I really need more quarters for my SS troops. Is there any way you could help me out? In particular, there's that really nice set of buildings up on the coast at Stralsund. Do you think we could have that? And do you have any other places that we might use for the SS? And Franz Schwede said, no problem. We'll just empty those institutions and you can take them over. So Stralsund and Lauenburg were both emptied in the latter part of 39 and the early part of 40. Some of the patients were sent to other Pomeranian institutions, like Treptow, for example, or Ueckermünde. But others were taken by train over to Lauenburg, and then across the border into a next territory in West Danzig, West Prussia. There they were unloaded from the train and put on trucks and taken about 10 kilometers further north and taken into a woods. And what happened next was that two SS men would take one person at a time by the arms and lead the person into the woods, conversing with the person all the way. And when they got to the designated spot, a third SS man would come up behind the person and shoot the person in the back of the neck. And then the body would be tossed into a ditch. And the shot was the signal to the SS men back with the group that it's time to bring the next patient from an asylum to go through the same shooting. I always thought SS people were kind of brave and courageous. This strikes me as very cowardly behavior. So hundreds of people were shot in this woods after having been removed from Stralsund and Lauenburg. And Bonhoeffer knew that these two institutions had been closed. And he's saying to his father, do you know what's going on with that? Paul Browner, who wrote a protest of euthanasia in a little bit later in the same year, also knew about these closings, and he was worried about where all the patients had gone. He said, these are two big places. They had about 2,000 patients apiece, and I don't quite understand where they have all gone. I mean, you can transport them somewhere else, but where did they wind up? So, during this time, looking at political, military, and social developments, the adult euthanasia program expanded to include a total of 6 killing centers. German aggression went north and west. Paul Browner visited the home of Karl Bonhoeffer in Berlin in May and writes about his visit. We don't know for sure whether Dietrich was there for that visit. Browner certainly would not have said that he was there if he had been, partly because Dietrich was in political trouble as it was. There was a protest by a German Lutheran bishop. Then the Luftwaffe attacked Britain. The British started bombing German targets. Catholic Cardinal Bauhauser from Munich protested euthanasia, and by the end of 1940, more than 35,000 adult patients had already been killed. What about Bonhoeffer? Well, his draft status was unclear once he was turned down to be a chaplain. This final collective pastorate out in the rural part of Pomerania was closed down, and he met with resistance group members 3 times in this period of time in 1940. In August of 40, he was forbidden to speak publicly, and finally he got an assignment to go to Munich to actually take on specific role with military intelligence. While he waited for his first assignment, he was a guest at a Benedictine abbey near Munich. And our younger son and I had a chance to visit Ettal in the mountains south of Munich. So this is where he worked on his book, Ethics. And if you want to see Bonhoeffer's mature thought about killing and also about mandatory sterilization, state-sponsored sterilization, you'll find discussions of both in this book. So here's what the cloister, the abbey, looks like in the wintertime. Beautiful setting with a library. Bonhoeffer had Catholic moral theologians and Protestant moral theologians whom he could read as he wrote. So what about killing people with disabilities? Every conscious killing of innocent life is arbitrary. And then there are 2 reasons that are given in favor of killing people with disabilities: concern for the sick and concern for the healthy. And Bonhoeffer rejects both reasons. Does consideration for the incurably ill and the heavy burden of their suffering demand the ending of their lives? And his answer is no. People with mental illness and people with intellectual disabilities generally enjoy their own lives. Stop making up excuses for killing them. Well, how about the society as a whole? Maybe you could save the society the cost of taking care of these people. And that, in fact, was the justification given by the regime This will save a lot of money if we don't have to feed these people anymore. And we've sterilized them, they're not going to reproduce, but they're still costing us a lot of money every month. And here he's attacking the notion of usefulness and says that there aren't any useless lives. Life created and preserved by God possesses an inherent right completely independent of its utility. There's no worthless life before God because God holds life itself to be valuable. And here he uses the story, the biblical story of the rich man and Lazarus, and says even a poor man like that is valuable to God. So this is another superhuman effort to try to liberate the human community from seemingly meaningless sickness. So this will destroy all human community, not benefit society. Well, what about sterilization? Well, the justification for this is that it's again, for the benefit of society. But it's a grave invasion of the human body. And if this boundary is crossed, then every boundary involving inviolability of the human body will fall. He does have this little proviso. When there's a state law on sterilization, as there certainly was, the position of the patient and the doctor will depend on how they perceive their duty to obey the government. And I don't have time to discuss that right now. So he gives himself a little bit of an out. Could there be circumstances where sterilization is justified? His proposal was segregate the two genders in institutions, and then there's no reason for invading their bodies with sterilization. Adult euthanasia continues. One of his close friends, a Catholic from Munich, was arrested and sent to a concentration camp. And finally, Bonhoeffer got an official assignment from military intelligence. Go to Geneva, Switzerland. Now, what Bonhoeffer said to anyone who asked him is, my job is to spy on what the churches are doing and saying abroad, and I will bring this information back to military intelligence so we know how to tailor our propaganda and be prepared for anything that the churches might try to do. What Bonhoeffer really was doing was giving information to the churches about atrocities being committed by his government so that the outside world had information, accurate information, about things like euthanasia and sterilization. So he visited Willem Visser te Hooft, and this gentleman, who's pictured here, wrote a report to his fellow church people in Britain. And in this report, he says, euthanasia continues. Nobody knows how many people have been killed, but it is generally believed that the number is very large. There have been a number of courageous protests by Bishop Wurm, a Protestant, by Cardinal Fallhaber, a Catholic, and by some doctors. So Bonhoeffer, this clearly came from Bonhoeffer to his Swiss contact. Bodelschwenk has refused to fill out the questionnaires which are used as the basis of selection, and so far no Bethel patients have been killed. very detailed information about what was happening with the euthanasia program. So we're coming close to the end of the story. Germany attacked the Soviet Union in June 22nd of 1941. In August, and this is pretty late, I'm sad to say, this is more than a year after Paul Brown's memorandum to the government in July of 1940, but this is a public sermon, and von Galen, a Catholic bishop, condemned euthanasia. The regime was not sure quite what to do with him. One faction said, it's clear you string him up and set an example for people who dare to attack our government. But the public relations people actually won the day. They said, oh, you'll make a martyr of this guy and we'll lose all the support we have in that part, northwest part of Germany. Hitler, in his table talk, said, we're going to put off doing anything to this bishop, but after the war, we'll settle accounts with him, and I won't stop until I've dotted every I and crossed every T. So the regime said, we're stopping the program. We're not going to kill any more adult patients. It was a subterfuge. They continued. They just didn't do it in killing centers with carbon monoxide gas. In the East, thousands of Jews were murdered by the so-called Einsatzgruppen. German Jews began to be deported. And late in 1941, the German military advance was stopped right on the doorstep of Moscow, and a very cold winter set in. Bonhoeffer traveled to Switzerland for a second time, and then in August and in early September, and then he and a lawyer friend named Friedrich Justus Perls wrote two reports on the deportation of the Jews from German cities. They called other towns to find out what was happening. They were very concerned. They saw people being taken away from their homes in Berlin. They didn't know what was happening. They found that it was happening in other cities as well. And you can find in Bonhoeffer's works two reports saying this: we don't know what's happening to these people, but this is a matter of grave concern. And he and von Donani actually helped to smuggle a group of Jews to Switzerland. It was called Operation Seven. And Yad Vashem has recognized Hans von Donani as a righteous among the nation for his role in this rescue effort. Dietrich Bonhoeffer has not been similarly recognized. So we come to the last milestone. And here Bonhoeffer is writing to members of the resistance, and he's hoping that they will forward the information to the generals who are leading Hitler's military campaign in the Soviet Union, and that those generals will turn against Hitler and either try to capture him or assassinate him. But the generals had all sworn a personal oath to Hitler as their leader, and they felt that it would be a sin to violate their oath. So I think the capture plan was the one that appealed to many. One of the schemes was capture Hitler and then have him examined by Karl Bonhoeffer, the psychiatrist, and declared to be insane, and then keep him locked up so that he can't do any more damage to the German people. Not a very likely scenario, given Hitler and those close to him. So Bonhoeffer helps to write a protest to the resistance, And I think his message is, this man is doing severe damage to humanity and to Christianity, and he needs to be stopped. So here's William Canaris, and here's Carl Gerdler, the former mayor of Leipzig. I think this is while he was on trial in Berlin. I think it's pretty obvious he's been mishandled while in prison. And this text by Bonhoeffer, late in his life, says, the killing of so-called unworthy lives, which has now become better known in the congregations and has claimed its victims from them, is viewed by Christians of all confessions with the deepest alarm and with revulsion, especially in connection with the Ten Commandments and any security of law, and is thus viewed as a sign of the anti-Christian stance of leading authorities in the Reich. So, the way the argument is framed is, this is an anti-Christian action, and you generals need to do something in response. So that's the last word, that's the sixth milestone. So I conclude that Bonhoeffer was very well informed about both sterilization and euthanasia. Sterilization, after all, was a formal public program authorized by law. Euthanasia was a secret program supposed to be classified information based only on a handwritten, hand-typed and signed note on Hitler's personal stationery. Bonhoeffer was indebted to Catholic thinking about these issues. He's undoubtedly the person who gave Visser to Hoof the information that he passed on to British Christians. And here are some of his contacts. So it's quite an interesting group. I think his brother-in-law, Hans von Danyanyi, in some ways got Dietrich into trouble by joining the resistance, and then Dietrich was invited in and became a kind of, I would say, an ethical advisor to the resistance about whether tyrannicide was permissible and under what circumstances. One of Dietrich's former students, Gerhard Ebeling, dealt in a pastoral way with one family who had been devastated by having their son taken away from an institution in Berlin. And he was said to have been shipped to Hartheim, Austria, but he was actually killed in Brandenburg, just southwest of Berlin. So, I think there's a consistent pattern. These matters were both of concern to Bonhoeffer. I think his discussion of the issues in these epics remains a classic critique. He also linked the situation of people with disabilities with that of African Americans, European Jews, and untouchables in India. And in his view, members of the Christian community have a special obligation to seek justice for members of these vulnerable groups and to protect them from harm. And Bonhoeffer linked the suffering of social outsiders with the suffering of God. So these are a few of the authors whom I consulted. They've really done wonderful research on Bonhoeffer and on the euthanasia program. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much for your Shall we take a 2 or 3 minute break
sure.
and reconvene? and move into our question and answer time. Thanks so very much for that.
We're reading that before we're going out.
Are you?
Our next,
for the soul of the
people? Yeah, for the soul of the people as well. Thank you so very much. May I give you...
Do you want to say it to your heart?
Do you mind?
No.
Yeah. Would you like a coffee or anything?
If you have pizza,
I can do, yeah.
That'd be great.
You bet.
Maybe Dr. Walters might want to see me.
UNC. UNC.
It's just a UNC.
UNC.
It's a Georgetown.
It's a very nice blue.
I like Georgetown.
You know my Georgetown.
Georgetown had a great game last night against Notre Dame. Yeah. They only gave them 41 points.
41 points?
41 points. I saw some highlights on ESPN. My wife and our two sons went to the game. They said it was great. I was on a train coming to Charlottesville. Yeah. But I saw them last Saturday. They hosted Villanova, and they won pretty handily that time, too. Well, they were ranked number 12 this week. I think they have about 5 or 6 losses, but only one at home.
That's actually really good. I mean, hopefully they'll get a good seed.
They should be 3 or 4, I think.
They haven't had a good the past couple of years. They haven't done very good.
No, they went out very fast last year, I think.
Been upset a couple of times. So hopefully it's a good year that they can pull away.
So where did you get your PhD?
At Yale.
Grad
school. Jim Childress and I overlapped by a year.
Oh, yeah, he's teaching me religion and environmental ethics.
Oh, good.
So he's a great, great lecturer.
We had dinner, he and Marcia and I had dinner together last night.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
He does a lot of my bioethics.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
That's
awesome. So you're in the
grad
program? Which year are you in?
First year.
Okay. Where did you do your undergrad?
I'm from Mississippi.
Are you?
So I did it at Southern Miss.
Uh-huh.
So I moved up here a couple years ago. Charles actually lived a little while in Mississippi. So he's from around that area. So he says I'm the first person from Mississippi to take any of his classes. So yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in how there's a lot of cool parallels. Yeah, cool. I mean, there's interesting parallels between like the Americas and Germany. When you talk about African Americans, Oliver was very into
He did. I mean, he loved going to the church in Harlem while he was in New York City. Yeah. And then he took a trip down through the South and even to Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he went to Mexico.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know he was like, he traveled all the way down.
And then went to Cuba, too, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
How good was his English?
Well, when he was living in London for those 2 years, I think his English got really good. Well, and also studying at Union Seminary for the year.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it was heavily accented, but...
Yeah.
But
in Germany, was he from?
Well, he was born in Breslau. which is now Wrocław in Poland, Wrocław or something like that.
Probably a lot of consonants thrown in there, you know, umlauts, do you often, do you go to Germany often?
Well, each summer with this study group, I go, yeah.
Are you going to the, there's one up in Sweden?
No, it conflicts with part of the study trip. Otherwise, I was at, my wife and I went to Prague in 2008.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, to the International Bonhoeffer Congress, yeah.
Well, there's definitely been like a resurgence in, more so in like, more so in like the Protestant churches, Protestant churches.
Well, Metaxas is biography.
You know, whether it's good or bad, I mean, Charles is not really a big fan of it. But
no.
It's, the fact that it's getting, you know, big press.
It's a very accessible book. I'm not too keen on Metaxas's main thesis. I mean, Bonhoeffer was not trying to support conservative evangelicals against Death of God people. That wasn't what he was about. And that seems to be. But still, it's. And I'm not sure that Metaxas can read a word of German.
Let's move. Moving along here. I can turn that off. Will you need this anymore?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I'll just close it.
So I would welcome your comments and questions.
Thanks again for that.
Oh.
May I just ask a general question? Karl Bonhoeffer and all of this? The father.
Yes. Well, Karl Bonhoeffer didn't do anything that might have caused him to be fired from his university position. So in that sense, he was more cautious than Dietrich. On the question of sterilization, Karl Bonhoeffer took the following tack. Well, if you're going to have a sterilization law based on heredity, then make sure that the disorder you're talking about is really hereditary. And he specialized in certain areas, I think, depression was one, and he was arguing that, well, these categories of patients with depression, there's no evidence that it's transmitted genetically, so they shouldn't be subjected to the sterilization program. I think Karl Bonhoeffer was just appalled by the euthanasia program. I mean, here he spent his whole life trying to help people with mental illness in particular, and now they're being slaughtered by the hundreds and thousands. I think he was revolted by the idea. His successor in his chair after he retired was actually involved in the euthanasia program. Karl Bonhoeffer confronted him, and his successor denied having anything to do with it. He just lied through his teeth. So whatever Karl Bonhoeffer could do against euthanasia, I think he did, including, oh, thank you very much, including welcoming Paul Brauner from an asylum north of Berlin into his home. I think setting up contacts between Brauner and some physicians whom he knew. But Karl Bonhoeffer never wrote anything against euthanasia. He and his spouse suffered terribly from the involvement of their family members in the resistance. I mean, we all know that Dietrich was executed in April of 45.
Hans von Danani was also probably shot in the streets. He was killed. It may have been at Sachsenhausen concentration camp in April of 45. Their son Klaus was also killed in April. So they lost three members of their the next generation in their family. Christine von Danani, it's amazing that she escaped with her life. Hans von Danani was putting together a chronicle of shame, as he called it, for the resistance, keeping records on the atrocities of the regime. He would bring home the information. His wife, Christine, would type it up at night, and then they would hide these files. When they felt the Gestapo getting close to them, resistance members destroyed some of the files, but not enough. And so the Gestapo found some incriminating files in at the military intelligence headquarters in a town called Zossen, Z-O-S-S-E-N. And that triggered the investigation. So the family suffered greatly. But Karl Bonhoeffer was a pretty old man by this time, and that family paid a very high price for their involvement in resistance. There is the Bonhoeffer house in West Berlin is now a house of conversation similar to the house here in Charlottesville. And I'm so glad that it's been preserved. You can go upstairs to the room that Dietrich stayed in when he was in Berlin, and they're not his books, but books like the ones he had are in that room, and that's the room in which he was arrested then in 1943. Yes?
I don't know if it's too far afield, but what's the fate of the sterilization laws? Is there any form of that that's still persists in Germany?
It's a really good question. There's been compensation for many of the people who suffered or whose families suffered under the Hitler regime. The people who were involuntarily sterilized, who are still surviving, and their numbers are diminishing, have appealed to the federal government of Germany for compensation, saying, we also suffered terribly. We never could have families. And thus far, the government has been unwilling to provide any compensation for the victims of sterilization. There surely would be no law on the books in Germany authorizing involuntary sterilization, just as there are no laws in the United States that authorize that or permit that. It's an interesting case study in the United States because the Supreme Court voted 8-1 in favor of upholding the constitutionality of the Virginia sterilization law. The analogy that was used is we have mandatory immunization to prevent smallpox, and this is just preventive health in another area. We're protecting the gene pool from disease. They didn't use gene pool, of course, but we're protecting society from disease. Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote the majority opinion. He's the one who he had fought in the Civil War, actually, so some of his language probably came from that experience. He said, if we can ask the best members of society to give up their lives in war, we can ask these people to give up their reproductive capacities. These people, who are these people? So There was one Catholic Supreme Court justice who didn't write a dissenting opinion, but he dissented from the majority decision. And now everybody thinks the one was right and the eight were wrong. And your blood will boil if you read the Buck versus Bell decision by Oliver Wendell Holmes. It's just atrocious. It was never officially overturned. It's just that the notion of privacy in matters of reproduction has come to mean much more in our society than using surgical sterilization to protect society against genetically transmitted diseases.
In the Virginia program in 1972?
Yeah. There's a really good documentary called the Lynchburg program.
Lynchburg story.
That's it. Yeah. And the American Civil Liberties Union did a lot to go to court on behalf of the victims of the sterilization law. There was a kind of apology, at least an expression of regret, in Virginia. Paul Lombardo, who used to teach here and now is teaching at Georgia Tech, did a lot. He went into the records of Carrie Buck's daughter, school records, and found that she was doing just fine till she died prematurely, maybe at the age of eight or so. And she was supposed to be the third generation of imbeciles. Carrie Buck herself was raped by probably a young man in her adoptive home, and that's how she got pregnant with her daughter. So it's a sad story of prejudice and labeling.
I have a question. I wonder, the fact that the Holocaust or the killing in Germany began, is
right. There are a couple of connections. One is the technology. Instead of taking people by train and then by truck to a woods and shooting them one by one, the planners thought, oh, it's much more efficient to bring the people to a center and kill them there. So they started building gas chambers. And there were six killing centers by the end. All using carbon monoxide gas. The same kind of thing happened with the killing of the Jews. Initially, it was shooting, sometimes from morning till dusk. And then the planners said, well, this is inefficient. Let's build killing centers. And they switched from carbon monoxide gas to prussic acid or cyclone B. Which was used for killing vermin. And that was used. Some of the people who were actually involved in supervising the killing centers for euthanasia when the program was officially stopped moved east and became the heads of killing centers in the east. So there are personnel connections. And the concept is exactly the same. Yes.
In Germany, has there been a clear acknowledgement by the government, an apology, reparation, specifically in regards to the killing of people with disabilities?
The killing of people with disabilities.
Yeah. I mean, my sense is, I haven't been in Germany, but my sense is there's a lot of acknowledgement of particularly the Jews that were killed.
Right. Oh, it's a matter for great embarrassment and shame, I would say. I shouldn't try to speak for people from Germany, but in 2000, 2010, it was the 50th anniversary of the euthanasia program in the killing centers getting started, so 1940 to 2010. And there were commemorative ceremonies all over Germany that year, often connected with institutions that take care of people with mental illness or intellectual disability today. And I was actually invited to go over and talk to two of these centers, and I talked about an attorney who wound up being in Brandenburg, southwest of Berlin, and he protested. He was a kind of a family law judge. He refused to go along with the euthanasia program. He said that no patients could be moved from one institution to another without his prior consent. He took his case all the way to the Ministry of Justice. He talked with Gertner. Gertner showed him Hitler's written authorization, and he said, that's not enough. So he was forced to resign, and he resigned from being a judge at the age of 43. And for the remainder of the war, worked on his farm southwest of Berlin in Brandenburg. I think some of his sons were drafted eventually, but they all came back. And after the war, he founded the organization called Aktion Sühnezeichen, the action for reconciliation or making... Yeah. So Lothar Kreisig is another person, like Paul Brauner or Dietrich Bonhoeffer, whom I just admire so much. Kreisig isn't known about very much in English. There are really good books in German about him, but I think he deserves an article in English. He fortunately had an escape route, retiring to his farm at the age of 43, but he also was a member of the Protestant Confessing Church, and I've wondered if he and Bonhoeffer and Brauner ever crossed paths or if they knew about each other during their lifetimes. But I don't see any evidence that they ever met. But they, in separate places, they were involved in the same kind of humanitarian work.
When you come out of the Berlin Philharmonic, just the most astonishing symphony orchestra in the world, and wait for a bus to the Tiergarten destination east, you'll see a large plaque that says in the adjacent lot, the T4 killing project was housed in between 1940 and 1941, 35,000 people killed.
Yep. On the question of memorials, one further thought occurs to me. At five of the six killing centers, there is presently a memorial and a kind of museum and exhibition in Germany. Brandenburg has a kind of a park with some columns, but there's, in my mind, it's not nearly as compelling. If you go to Grafeneck down in Württemberg, it's way out in the countryside down toward the Swiss Alps. But there's a studies center, and there are conferences held there. There are memorial services held every year. There's a historical scholar there. They do a lot in educating the next generation. I think in many ways, for both the Jewish Holocaust and euthanasia, the German government and German society has done a much better job of acknowledging the past than we have. I mean, what do we say about the near extermination of the American Indians? You can go to the American Indian Museum, but it's really soft-pedaled. And there was a huge controversy about what to say concerning the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. I think the Enola Gay is at a branch of the Smithsonian near Dulles Airport. But what were you going to say about the Enola Gay? Were you going to present any of the suffering of people who were injured or killed in the attack? Nothing. I mean, it just became a huge controversy, and so I think nothing was said about the effect on the Japanese people.
It's at the Huzar Kuzu Museum, which was near Dulles.
Is it?
And it's on display as a plane, but there's no acknowledgement. I mean, there's no pictures of the destruction. There's no numbers of people who were killed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's presented in this museum with other pieces of, you know, planes and other aeronautical things. It's sort of, I think, kind of a neat piece of technology, in my sense.
Yeah.
And I know Catholic workers have been a part of civil disobedience there and
And, I mean, we're now going to have a museum of African-American history. That's going to, I hope it will be an honest museum. That's another part of the past for Europeans with pale skin, who Hitler called Aryans. Yes.
So I was intrigued when you basically said that in Bonhoeffer's rejection of the sterilization program, he sort of resisted the logic of this is what they want or is it better than them, and he resisted the notion of social utility.
Right.
And you just sort of off the cuff said that he insisted on a proper moral description of you're just killing people. And it seems to me that given that the notion of moral blindness often comes up with these types of discussions, would you speculate a bit on just what funded his capacity to be able to see through the stated reasons and just kind of directly name this particular phenomenon for what it is, or what it was? I mean, it seemed that moral vision is really important. But how was he able to ascertain that and keep it so steadily? Or was it steady?
I think it was very steady. I think his paternal grandmother had something to do with it. If you ever get a chance to read Bonhoeffer's eulogy for her, I think it was from 35, it is the most beautiful statement. And in this statement, he says, in the last years of her life, she was afflicted with a great sadness because she saw people whom she cared about suffering, particularly the Jews. This is in a eulogy in 1935 in Hitler's Germany. I can't account for it. He seemed to have an empathy which one wishes more people would have. If he goes to New York City and studies at Union Seminary from 29 to 30, he winds up befriending an African-American, going to the church in Harlem, then going down to Washington and talking to civil rights leaders there, tries to go to a restaurant with an African-American friend, finds that the restaurant won't serve a black and a white together, takes a trip through the South, sees for himself manifestations of racism, when he goes back to Germany, I mean, within a few years, he's, I think, feeling the same kind of empathy for Jews in Germany. He's worried, he's thinking about the people with disabilities at Bethel and what an impressive service this is, with people with disabilities being in the majority, and it reminds him of an etching by Rembrandt. I just think he had a tremendous capacity for empathy, and I think his vision started there, and it allowed him then to just screen out all the propaganda. His family was not buying anything of Hitler's propaganda. I mean, they were conservative in some ways in their politics, but I think they saw the leaders of the Nazi state as a bunch of gangsters, intruders on a high culture. I think his family had something to do with it, but there's a concern for the oppressed, the weak, the suffering, that I think is a constant theme through his whole life. And then he himself suffered in prison and was executed at the end. Yes. In the back. Yes. There was, I'll see if this responds to your question. There was on a somewhat separate track a so-called children's euthanasia program. And that, the way that was set up was that midwives and physicians had a legal duty to report any child born with deafness or physical deformities to the government. And then what the leaders of the Children's Euthanasia Program would do is say to the parents, we'd like to treat your child who has these disabilities at a specialized treatment center. Will you allow us to take the child to the center and treat your child? In fact, these centers were tied with research institutions in Heidelberg or in Berlin, for example, and the children would be studied for a while, their abilities would be assessed, and then they would be killed in such a way that their brains would be preserved, and anatomists would work on their brains, seeing if they could make correlations between the structures of the brain and the disability of the child. So in that case, the parents were consulted, but they were deceived. In the case of the adult program, the patients were moved from their home institutions to a killing center and killed. And then the parents were informed that the person had been moved. And a few weeks later, a condolence letter would come. Oh, we're so sorry to tell you that your loved one who was moved here recently has died of, and then there was a kind of a menu of 20 choices, a lung infection or a heart attack or something. And we've had to cremate the remains of the your loved one, but if you'd like, we can send you an urn containing the ashes of your loved one. We're really sorry. So it was deception from start to finish. And even when the parents were on the ball and tried to follow up as soon as they got the first notification, it was too late. There were a lot of very angry patients who didn't believe the letters, condolence letters, and who protested. And many of their protests have been preserved, but they were just powerless. Now, does that respond to your question? Yeah, so the children's program was on a separate track, and at least the parents were consulted in advance, but they were deceived about what was going to be done. Yes?
I have a question about Hitler with the larger program in general.
Right.
So I understand that, I guess, like, in his mind he was doing it because it was for the betterment of the Aryan race. Or I don't really
yes.
know if that was his reason.
Yes.
So I just don't understand how he could justify that to himself. Because, like, if it was for the betterment of the Aryan race, why couldn't he tell the public about it? Because, like, would the public also be for the betterment of the Aryan? Like, I just don't understand how he and the people on the inside.
Right. Good question. Yeah. So he was purging the dregs of the Aryan race. I mean, that's the picture he had in his mind. But I think he and his PR people were worried that the public wouldn't understand or wouldn't accept the idea. And so it was better just to keep it a secret and hope that nobody noticed, or if there was any opposition, it would be sort of one family at a time. So Brauner's memorandum in July of 40 was a terrific threat to the T4 program, because Brauner had pieced together most of what was happening. He didn't know how the patients were being killed. At least he wasn't sure. He thought maybe lethal injections. But he knew they were dying. And he cleverly compared the numbers assigned to several patients in the Grafenegg killing center and said, well, in March we had the number A, 1,500, and in June we had the number A, 3,111. So that's 1,500 people, but this place only has 100 beds. So how could 1,500 people die in one small facility for one small asylum during this short span of time? I mean, he had essentially, with the help of contacts and phone calls and correspondence, he had figured out 80% of the adult euthanasia program within 6 months of the start. It's an amazing bit of detective work. But the memorandum that went in that caused consternation didn't slow down the program. It took that public sermon. That was a real threat. And then they said, oh, well, we're not sending people to killing centers anymore, and it became much more decentralized. The next round for some of the killing, well, in Württemberg, there was such a level of protest that by the end of 1940, Heinrich Himmler was writing to Brack, the deputy director of the T4 program. I'm just hearing a lot of noise out of Württemberg. I think the best thing would be to close down Grafenegg. And they shut it down. And they moved the personnel up to a place closer to Frankfurt. I'm blocking on the name of the killing center that replaced Grafenegg. So they just went to a friendlier territory. after rumors became so widespread and the regime was worried about resistance to the program based on opposition to euthanasia. Similarly, there was the killing center in Brandenburg on the Havel River. It's about 40 kilometers southwest of Berlin. It was downtown. They had this smokestack, and people in the city could smell that the remains of people were being burned. And so, again, there was a protest by the local people, and so they moved that center way out into the countryside. I took a train trip out to the successor center, and it took about an hour and a half by train from Berlin to get out to the more rural center. And if the regime learned anything, it was not to put any killing centers on German soil. So if you look at the killing centers for the Jewish Holocaust, they're all in Poland or what used to be Poland, out of the sight of the German people.
Yeah. Because the impression I get from the letter is that he was drafted or something because he was looking to become a chaplain, so he had to fight. But how is it that a man who the Nazi government was aware was subversive got a job with an intelligence agency?
Great question.
Was trusted to travel internationally and gather intelligence and not become a double agent. It just seems very spurious.
So let's start with this little group of about 50, I think it was called Section Z within military intelligence. So it's 50 out of 13,000. And they're around Hans Oster in particular, Canaris, the head of the military intelligence, backs them. Donani is there. I think, well, Heydrich would have been the domestic parallel to this military intelligence, which was supposed to be international. And I'm sure Heydrich had his suspicions about what was going on there. But Dietrich Bonhoeffer was looking for a way not to shoot Russians in particular, in a war on behalf of Hitler's army. He tried the route of becoming a military chaplain. That was cut off. The regime said, these people who are ministers or training to be ministers have to first show that they're brave and fight on the front, and then if they survive and do well, then we can consider them for chaplaincy, but none of this immediately going into chaplaincy. So being a chaplain was cut off, but Bonhoeffer did not want to flee to another country, and he did not want to fight in the German army with a weapon. And so he tried to find a way to get himself exempted from the draft. He tried for what was called a UK classification. And with the help of Donani, and Oster, he somehow got it. I think the regime was, they knew that Donani and Dietrich were not friends of the regime, but I think the regime had so many other issues to deal with that they deferred doing anything about them until several years had gone by. It was actually currency violations in connection with smuggling the Jews to Switzerland that got them in trouble initially. There was something about the money that got transferred to Switzerland for these Jews that made the Gestapo suspicious. And then the Gestapo got onto these documents at the military intelligence headquarters and finally just closed in on them. Hitler was vindictive to the last minute. I think there were about 5,000 people killed, accused of somehow being related to the attempt on his life on July 20th, 1944. And Hitler, Bonhoeffer and Danagny were among the last group executed for that. So, in a way, it is totally implausible. I mean, would the regime really believe that Bonhoeffer was going to spy on the churches in Switzerland? They'd have to be pretty stupid to believe that, but I think they just had other priorities, and maybe they figured if he's not in Berlin stirring up trouble, if he's with military intelligence out in the countryside, it's better for us than if he's in Berlin. Maybe that was part of their thinking, but I doubt it. And there's this whole mysterious year. I mean, once this collective pastorate in Pomerania, the last one, is closed down, Bonhoeffer's essentially unemployed and draft eligible. And he doesn't really get an assignment for months. And then, so what was he doing all this time? It's a gap in his life that we don't know much about. And he actually, his biographer, Bethke, says that he tore pages out of his diary in August and September of 1940. So I think he had phone numbers or names that he was worried the Gestapo would see that would incriminate other people. So he just tore the pages out. And that's part of the reason we have a gap. I think even Eberhard Bethke didn't know everything that was going on during that time. It's a good question.
Could a missing piece of this be, well, I mean, it seems like there are a number of ways of thinking about that, but that question reminds us that Bonhoeffer was not as well known in 1941 in all of Germany, as we might imagine in retrospect,
right,
that there were that there was not strong communication between Berlin and Munich and this assignment in Munich. And there was also a rivalry of sorts between the Abwehr and the Gestapo. But isn't and there are other things like that. But doesn't it also seem inescapably clear that Bonhoeffer would have offered reassurances that he was on board?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I think he would have probably submitted reports saying, here are the nasty things that the predecessor organization of the World Council of Churches is
right.
saying about us in Geneva, or this is what the British press is saying about us, this is what the Anglicans are saying against our government. Isn't this terrible? I would imagine he was submitting reports.
His desperate desire not to be drafted, not to fight, with his
right.
sudden willingness to provide this information. And those missing diaries, I've always wondered that could work
yeah.
both ways.
Well, at the time, Karl Barth couldn't figure out
yeah.
what was going on with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he needed to be reassured, I think, by a personal meeting with Bonhoeffer that Bonhoeffer hadn't gone over to the dark side. He really was, once Bonhoeffer was in this spy agency, it's sort of like the Heydrich was the head of the FBI, And Canaris was the head of the CIA. If you think about parallel institutions now, or the National Security Agency. And so Bart really was worried that Bonhoeffer had sold out and had to be reassured that he hadn't. And so I guess Bonhoeffer had to assure him that, no, I'm working to try to bring down this regime, and this is the only way I know how to do it and stay alive.
Thank you.
And it's thinking about from the wider German public and their thoughts on eugenics, on sterilization, on euthanasia, and, you know, realizing that in the Western world, kind of eugenics was the hot thing in the early 20th century. So, if, you know, the kind of logic of that is that it's a better thing to have a society that is healthier, stronger, smarter. And it sounds like with sterilization, that was a pretty accepted thing, that sterilization is a good thing to do publicly if people want to work.
There are quite a few countries who adopted similar programs,
right,
including Sweden. Yeah.
And so if the thought behind sterilization is that it's better if these folks who we deem to be less smart, less healthy, whatever,
right,
don't even exist in the first place, euthanasia is the next logical step from that. If these people shouldn't exist in the first place, why not kill them as well when they already exist? But it sounds like from the way this euthanasia program was carried out that there was concern that people wouldn't take that next logical step. And I'm just kind of wondering was that really something that the broader public would have been upset about? If so, why? Why would they be upset about that, but think sterilization is fine?
Yeah.
So just from like kind of
good
rationality behind
it. Right. Good. Well, let's start with Catholics and Protestants on sterilization. The Catholics had a great document from 1930, Casti Connubii, in which Pius XI said, in response to Anglican weakening on this question, that any form of contraception, including sterilization, is morally wrong. So when the sterilization law came up and was enacted in Germany, incidentally, the regime put off the announcing the sterilization law until a couple of weeks after the Concordat was signed between the Vatican and the Hitler regime. So that was a little clever strategy on the part of the regime. The Catholic bishops really, I think, fought the eugenic sterilization program up to a point. What they were at pains to make sure of was that no Catholic people were forced to participate in sterilization against their conscience. And so they were looking for a way to exempt Catholic physicians and nurses from direct cooperation with sterilization. And they would draw fine distinctions like, well, it's all right to wheel the patient to the operating room, but not to assist in surgery. So I don't want to caricature this. They actually spoke from the pulpit, and they basically one Sunday morning said, early in 1934 when the law went into effect, here's the new law that has now gone into effect. We remind you that sterilization is against the moral law and against Catholic Church teaching. And the regime was very upset about that. Protestants were divided on sterilization, and I think perhaps a majority of Protestants accepted sterilization. There was a minority, and Paul Browner was in that minority. But I think that liberal Protestants, and then also people who sympathized with the regime, thought it was okay. There was a kind of a rationale for reducing the level of disability in society. I just think there's such a quantum leap between performing surgery on someone, even if it's risky, in the case of women in particular in the 1930s, and killing people. Think about all the differences. In the one case, there's a law, and you might not like the law, you might protest the law. In the other case, it's subterfuge from start to finish. It's classified information. You're not supposed to talk about this. And then you're not just taking away someone's reproductive capacities. You're bringing their lives to an end. So I just think I think the regime was worried that the Christian majority of Germany would find the killing of people with disabilities abhorrent. There were some parents who more or less said, there were some parents who objected more to the deception than they did to the killing. They felt that it was all right that the suffering of their loved one was ended, but they hated the fact that the government wasn't leveling with them, which is kind of a strange position. But I think there was much more robust opposition by parents and families to the killing of people with disabilities than there was to the sterilization program. So in one sense, you can say it's the next logical step. But in another sense, it's such a radical move from surgery to killing.
If anyone not in the seminar needs to leave, if we could just have another question or two, is that okay, Leroy?
Sure.
Josh has a question. I saw someone over here, Sarah. Yeah.
I just wondered how original, at least within kind of Protestant thought, is whole basis of human rights and his thinking there kind of was and where it kind of grows out of.
That's a very interesting question, and he does use rights language at times, the right to bodily life. I'll say one thing. I was just reading a book by a man with the last name of Moses he's an Australian historian, and he's written about Bonhoeffer's... Bonhoeffer and his family and their relationship to Prussian political thinking. And have you ever wondered what form of government Dietrich Bonhoeffer would have wanted for a post-Hitler Germany? Well, I was fascinated by this question, so I dived into the second half of Moses' book, and I haven't read the first half yet. Bonhoeffer knew the parliamentary democracies of the United States and Great Britain from having lived in both countries. And he didn't think Germany was ready for a parliamentary democracy. He would have preferred a move back to the pre-Weimar Republic form of government. So probably an emperor and probably what looks to us like an autocratic regime. And then I think his view was that if you put that in place and it evolved over time, maybe the German people would mature to the point where you could have a parliamentary democracy, but not, certainly not right after you got rid of Hitler and the other leaders of the Hitler regime. On the rights question, I mean, I wonder whether his time talking to civil rights leaders in the United States might have been an influence. Or maybe his time in the United States and Britain convinced him that rights were quite important. You can also maybe derive a rights theory from some of his notions about the various mandates that are to be in place in human society and human culture. But it's a good question. And rights language was not the primary mode of discourse in German theology, that's for sure. Yes.
You said earlier that Hitler's view is that while people focused on the war, he could kind of accomplish things basically that he couldn't have otherwise.
Right.
I was wondering if there was one of those things, like the domestic accomplishments versus the greater war, if one of those was more important to him, if one kind of spurred him to pursue the other, or whether they just kind of conveniently played out together.
So, very good question also. Doris Bergen talks about race and space in her War and Genocide book, and I think those two words really capture a lot of Hitler's philosophy. So the Aryan race has to be promoted, and that's at the expense of non-Aryan peoples. And among the non-Aryan people, the Jews are especially dangerous opponents. In his view, they're somehow pulling the strings behind British and American capitalism and Bolshevism in the Soviet Union. And they're just trying to get the nations of the world to fight against each other so that they will emerge with greater power in the end. And then we've talked about space and getting an empire in the East because Germany was crowded and every great country had to have an empire and preferably a land empire. Now, this may not be what your question was getting at, but toward the end of the war, I was reading a new history of the World War II called Inferno by Max Hastings. And he says toward the end of the war, Hitler had to make choices between killing the Jews and supporting the war effort. And if he had to make a forced choice, he was worried that he was going to lose the war when both the Soviet Union and the American army were involved. He seemed to think at some moments that at least I can exterminate the Jews, even if I can't win the war. And so I'll have accomplished something. And if he had a point or two, he makes statements like, if the German people, that is the Aryan race, is not strong enough to defeat the Soviet Union and the United States, then it's not a worthy people. And so the German people deserves to go down because it didn't rise to the test. I did my best. My generals screwed up all over the place. I tried to correct their strategy, but if we don't win this war, it's not my fault. And in this Darwinian struggle for supremacy, it turns out we're not the fittest after all.
Thank you. Thanks again. You've really given us so much today. Thanks for making an effort to come and spend some time with us here.
Well, I'm really excited about the research that you're doing and looking forward to your new biography of Bonhoeffer. Right.